Jim, where I used to see Frank at a lot was in Atlantic City. That was before the gambling became, everybody used to, the season in Atlantic City, we would be up there all the time, you know, every weekend almost, at the Club Harlem. It was a homeboy of mine, he's dead now, Big Romy, he moved to New York. So one evening we was up there and Frank came up, Frank Matthews. So Romy introduced me to Frank. He said, "Shorty, this is Frank Matthews." I said, "Yeah." You know, we shook hands and we chatted. And we see, Frank liked the girls. He was up there for the girls. He chased them girls like crazy, man, you know. And he used to come to Baltimore a lot and hang out with another buddy that I grew up with, one of my childhood friends named Joe Perry. And he used to keep a lot of money in the trunk of the car and a lot of product in the trunk of the car. I don't know if it was true or not, but that's what they used to say about Frank. It was rumored.
What was your impression?
He was a real colorful, flamboyant type of human being, you know. He was kind of loud and was always jolly, you know, friendly like type guy. You know, that was the whole thing about living in that world, in that game. Money, clothes, jewelry, and women. Those four things in that order, you know. When I first met him, his name was not out there like that, but as the years went, like a couple of years later, 68, 69, his name was ringing like doorbells. But nobody never tried him. Nobody never tried to do anything to him. You know, as much money as they say he used to have in that car, you know, that's surprising. That's amazing. It must have been dubbed that he ain't to be messed with. You know what I mean? Because I don't know if anybody ever, when I started going to New York, well, you would see a lot of guys from Baltimore up there copping, you know, doing what they do or doing whatever they know to do. And Fayetteville, we always, all after we go through the barracks and trim the soldiers, and we would all meet at a guy named Tommy Hart's house. That's when I first got familiar with Ike Atkinson. They didn't give, you know, if you was a young guy, real young, they didn't deal with kids back then. The older guys would tell us, "Y'all get away from me," and blah, this. And a drug connection was sacred. If you had a drug connection, man, you had something going on. It would be somebody that you knew that went to New York, or was living in New York, that would be your contact. The first time I went to New York, I was in 1959.
And you went often to New York?
Yeah. In 1959, I went to New York as a gambler. See, I used to gamble, play crap and cards. I was what you call a Solomon. I made my living gambling at that time, you know.
You were like Ike was a gambler.
Yeah. I met Ike as a gambler in 1964 in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Fort Bragg. Yes? My name is Clinton Shorty Buse. I was born and I'm a native of Baltimore, Maryland. It was a poor community. We lived in poor housing. From that poor housing, we went to poor schools, received a poor education. And that poor education sent us on poor paying jobs. It returned us right back into the poor community. We didn't have many choices. So if you don't have a choice, you have to take a chance. Don't take a chance. In those days, you didn't have a chance. So what we did, we resorted to the life of crime. So a lot of us took to what was available for us, you know, gambling, trying to pimp women, drug dealing, and all those types of things. 61, 62, and when it started getting real popular. And then around 1964, 65, it was really growing, it was booming, like, you know. Yeah, but this was being before the Vietnam vets. You know, the guys started growing up. They started using drugs. The feds wasn't even in the city at that time, but just local. You know, a guy might have been a stick-up guy. he might stop sticking up and start selling drugs because he had a less chance of getting caught. Just started gravitating toward that way of life, you know, because it was profitable. That was on an Easter Sunday morning. We was getting ready to leave out of there when he got killed. We had just left from that area when Fat Ty, they call him. Yeah. But I think they killed him out of jealousy. That black mafia was leaning on everybody at that time. You know, if you didn't get him some money, you couldn't operate in Philly. And ain't too much change about that right now as we speak. You know, he had good social skills, and a lot of people liked him, you know what I mean? And obviously, he did a lot of favors for people. It's by the late 60s, 69, 70, everybody knew who he was and what he was about, you know, a few years before. And I think he was supplying about 20 cities. You got to have it big to do that. You know, it was like a ransom, really. You know, they didn't think he was going to really make that, you know. If you're in that world or you out in that world, you don't want to see nobody go down, whether you know them, whether you like them, whether you don't like them. Even though what he was doing was wrong, but, you know, he made it possible for a lot of people to have a lot of things or to live fairly decent. Yeah. But the last time that they saw him in New York, he came through there with bags of money, they say, and just he wasn't even trying to win. He just wanted to leave some money and leave his mark. He wasn't even trying to win. He just was putting it on the table and left out, you know.
Were you surprised that he jumped?
I think he had it planned out where, and as he knew that this way of life was eventually or would come to an end. It seemed like to me he knew it was coming and he was prepared to make his move. And if he's still living, man, I take my hat off to him, you know. You know, you got to have people to look up to. And I look up to this man because he pulled it off. The reason why I think that he might not still be around is he had the girl when she was 23 years old. She came from a good family. Both of her parents, Ron, as you know, were school teachers. And you also know that they put a tap on her mother's phone for 5 years, and they never heard of nothing from her. That's the part that makes me think that something happened to her. You know what I mean? Because she would have probably gotten restless and homesick, lonely, and wanted to get back to her family, and they never heard from her either. Whoever their connect was or whoever he trusted to that extent might have said, come on, we're going to do this. We're going to get you out of here. And they had $30 million. They claim he had a lot of money. Took him and whacked him. And I don't know what they did with them bodies, but I don't know. They did a good job if it's like that.